Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to As It Is, our daily magazine program. I'm Ana Mateo. Today is the first day of November. Many people celebrated Halloween Saturday night. Halloween celebrations are very popular in the United States. In the Washington, D.C. area, we are enjoying beautiful autumn weather. Leaves on the trees are changing color, turning yellow, red, or orange. And the weather is starting to cool down. This is the time when many people bring out their cold weather clothes. Boots, scarves, hats, sweaters, and long pants. And today, that is what we will be talking about. Clothes. If you had a choice, would you buy a low-cost article of clothing, one that doesn't cost much but is of less than average quality? Or are you more likely to spend more money and buy something of higher quality? That is what Kelly Jean Kelly explores in her story today. Let's listen as she describes the differences between what critics are calling fast fashion and slow fashion.
A few years ago, Maxine Bedat, who is now in her early 30s, looked in her closet. It was full of clothes, but she had nothing to wear.
And that was because it was a closet full of fast fashion that was falling apart, that was based on hyper trends from one season to the next.
Fast fashion means clothes that are inexpensive, but look like the latest designs from top fashion houses. Well-known fast fashion stores include H&M, Forever 21, Zara, and Topshop. One reason for the success of fast fashion is social media. A report by the investment research firm Bernstein found that millennials, people born in the 1980s and 90s, want to wear a variety of clothes in the photos they post on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. As a result, many businesses that offer trendy, low-cost clothes are growing. But some millennials are not happy with the rise of fast fashion. Maxine Bedat, the woman with the closet full of clothes but nothing to wear, calls fast fashion exhausting. She says she was tired of always shopping for what was in style. Instead, she says, she wanted to buy fewer clothes that she could wear over and over. Other people wanted the same thing, she says.
I just saw a post today from one of the biggest bloggers, and it's, what is her favorite white t-shirt? And I think that's really, telling about where we are today. It's not just about having something new every single day, but what is something that's beautiful and what is something that's quality, and what brands do we want to be wearing that reflect the values that we hold?
So Ms. Bedat and a business partner, Saraya Darabi, started a slow fashion clothing company called Zadie. Slow fashion means clothes that last a long time. They are often classic colors and shapes and are made from natural materials that are biodegradable over time.
Thanks, Kelly. Now we will take a short break. When we return, we will hear the rest of Kelly's report.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to As It Is from VOA Learning English. Today's show is about fashion. There was a trend, a popular movement, in the U.S. for fast fashion. Fast fashion means clothes that don't cost much. But that trend is changing, and fast. People now seem to want clothes that are made well, and that will last longer. Part of the reason is to keep clothes out of landfills. We continue now with Kelly Jean Kelly's report.
The terms fast fashion and slow fashion are related to fast food and slow food. Fast food is still popular in the U.S., but many restaurants increasingly offer higher quality, more expensive, and relaxed meals. Like slow food, slow fashion also aims to use sources that are good for the environment and workers. Maxine Bedat says, people in her generation want to know where their clothes come from and who is making them. Their interest comes in part after a clothing factory collapsed in Bangladesh in 2013. Over 1,000 people who were making cheap clothes in poor conditions died. To answer millennials' demand for information about the products they buy, Ms. Bedat's company, Zadie, includes details about the history of the brands. It also describes the process by which the clothes are made. Ms. Bedat says, Zadie aims to tell shoppers where their clothes come from, where they go, and how they impact the world. The international business H&M is answering millennials' demands for stylish but sustainable fashion in another way. It has created a recycling program for clothes. The program invites people to bring clothes they no longer want to H&M stores. Shoppers who donate old clothes can receive a discount on new things they buy. H&M does several things with shoppers' old clothes. They sell some clothes again. They turn some clothes into other useful items, such as cleaning cloths. And they reduce the rest to fibers that can be reused as building materials, for instance. An H&M spokesperson wrote in an email to VOA that the program aims to help the environment. We have a clear vision to avoid and minimize waste that goes into landfills, the spokesperson wrote. H&M reported that in 2014, it collected over 7,600 tons of unwanted clothing. That is about 38 million t-shirts. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And I'm Anna Mateo. Thanks for listening. You can hear another As It Is tomorrow, both as a podcast and on the radio. But don't go away. Coming up next, we have a special report for the Halloween season on words and their stories, followed by the program People in America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
Now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. In an earlier program, we talked a lot about the devil. In many religions, the devil is the most powerful spirit of evil. Religious leaders teach that hell is where the devil lives. They also say hell is the place where bad people go after they die. You can hear many Americans using the words devil and hell in everyday expressions. But the list of expressions is just too long for one show. So get ready for the sequel, what we're calling Part 2, Hell, the Devil's Hangout. Many people think of hell as a hot place full of fire. So a snowball would not have much of a chance there. And that is where this expression comes from, a snowball's chance in hell. Let's say you applied for a promotion at work, but so did your boss's daughter. You do not have a snowball's chance in hell. Your boss is not going to hire you over his daughter. It will be a cold day in hell, and when hell freezes over, also mean the same thing. There is no chance that something will happen. For example, if you have a fight with a friend and never want to talk to him again, you could say, "It will be a cold day in hell before I ever call him again. Our friendship is over." Or, "Sure, I'll call him when hell freezes over." But be careful. These expressions are very informal and very strong. You would only use them with your close friends and peers. So if your boss asks if your work will be done before you go home, you would never say, "It'll be a cold day in hell when that happens," unless you want to lose your job. Sometimes we just use the expression hell like this. She's a hell of a dancer. He's a hell of a writer. That was a hell of a good time. Hell of a runs together as if it's one word, hell of a. Again, this is very slang and very informal. Hell is reported to be not only hot, but miserable. So if something is going to hell in a handbasket, it is becoming very bad very quickly. If you have been to hell and back, you have been through a very difficult period and lived to tell about it. Here is an example.
I'm glad to see that Julie is back to her old self.
Me too. She's been through so much this past month. Her mom died, her son got really sick, and then she was in that terrible car accident.
Wow, she has really been to hell and back.
But if you do want to visit hell, there is a road you can take. The road of good intentions. Let me explain. When we say the road to hell is paved with good intentions, we mean that positive intentions may have negative outcomes. Paved here means to line a street. So the road to hell is lined with well-intended ideas that went terribly wrong. You do not have to have good intentions to be hell on wheels. People who are hell on wheels are aggressive, tough, mean, or just difficult to deal with. For example, watch out for the new woman in sales. She's good, but she is hell on wheels. Stay out of her way. Being hell on wheels is different than raising hell. People who are hell on wheels might actually be doing a good job. But if you are raising hell, you are simply behaving badly. Let's listen to this dialogue.
When she was a teenager, she really raised hell.
Tell me about it. She skipped school, got into trouble every weekend. What a hellraiser.
Her poor parents.
If you raised too much hell in one place, you may find you need to leave that place, like a bat out of hell. In other words, crazy fast. I'm Ana Mateo.
Thank you. Now, the VOA Special English Program, People in America. I'm Steve Ember. In the early days of the last century, an American doctor wrote about the Native American people called the Lakota, or Sioux. His name was Charles Eastman. He was one of the few people to ever win the trust of the old people. He could do this because he, too, was a Lakota Sioux. His Lakota name was Ohiyasa. When Ohiyasa was 15 years old, he was sent to an American school for Indian children. He was given the English name Charles Eastman. He did very well in school. He was chosen to go on to college and then to medical school. He returned to his tribe as their medical doctor. In the early part of the past century, Charles Eastman saw that many of the old people were dying. He feared their history and culture would die with them. He talked to many of the very old members of the Sioux. He put their words down on paper. One of these stories was about a famous Indian fighter named Rain in the Face. This is the story that Dr. Eastman wrote.
About 2 months before the great Sioux warrior Rain in the Face died, I went to see him for the last time. "Friend," I said, "at home, when the old men were asked to tell the brave things they had done, the tobacco pipe was passed. So come, let us smoke now to the memory of the old days." He took some of my tobacco and filled his long pipe. The old man lay on a small bed covered by a red blanket. He was all alone that day. Only an old dog lay silent by his feet. Finally, he looked up and began telling me about his long life.
"I was born near the Cheyenne River about 70 years ago. My family were not great chiefs, but they were good warriors and great hunters. I was given the name Rain in the Face as a young man. This was after a great battle when we were on a warpath against the Gros Ventre tribe. I had painted my face with war paint that day. I had wished my face to represent the sun when partly covered with darkness, so I painted it half black, half red. We fought all day in the rain, and some of the war paint on my face was washed away. Much of the black and red paint had run together, so I was given the name Rain in the Face. We Sioux considered it an honorable name."
As he told his story, old Rain seemed to come alive. He smiled as he talked. He seemed younger, and his eyes shined.
"One of the most daring attacks that we ever made was against the army base called Fort Totten in North Dakota. The fight took place in the summer of 1866. I had a special friend then. His name was Wapepe. He was known to the white men as Fearless Bear. He was the bravest man among us. In those days, Wapepe and I called each other brother friend. This was a life and death promise among the Sioux. What one does, the other must do. And that meant that I must be with him in the attack. And if he was killed, I must fight until I died also. I prepared for death. I painted my face with my special sign, half red, half black. Now, the signal for the attack was given. My horse started even with Wapepe, but his horse was faster than mine. This was bad for me. By the time I came close to the fort, the soldiers had somewhat recovered from the surprise of our attack. They were aiming their guns more carefully. Their guns talked very loud, but hit few of us. Their guns were like an old dog with no teeth who makes much noise and becomes more angry the more noise he makes. How much harm we did, I do not know. When the fight was finished, I saw blood on my leg. Both my horse and I were wounded.
I knew that Rain in the Face had taken part in two of the most famous fights with white soldiers. One of these fights was near an army fort named Fort Phil Kearny in Wyoming. The other was the most famous battle between the Sioux and the American army. Rain in the Face was in the battle against the famous Army General George Armstrong Custer. That great battle took place near the Little Bighorn River. I asked him to tell me about these two great battles.
We attacked a fort west of the Black Hills. The white soldiers called it Fort Phil Kearny. It was there we killed almost 100 soldiers. They were commanded by a captain named Fetterman. It was a big fight. Many famous chiefs were there. Crazy Horse, Sitting Bull, Red Cloud, and many young warriors, Sword, American Horse, Crow King. The plan for the battle was decided after many meetings. The main group would stay hidden from view, and a few of the bravest young men were chosen to attack a group of white men. These men were cutting wood for the fort. We were told not to kill these men, but to chase them back to the fort and then ride slowly away. We did this. A large group of soldiers commanded by Captain Fetterman followed us. They thought we were only few in number. We led them into the trap. It was a matter of a very few minutes before every soldier lay dead. The very next year, we signed a peace treaty at Fort Rice in North Dakota. Almost all the Sioux chiefs signed the treaty. The treaty said all the country north of the Republican River in Nebraska, including the Black Hills and the Bighorn Mountains, was to be always Sioux country. No white man could go there without our permission. After the treaty was signed, the white men found the yellow metal they call gold in our country. They came in great numbers. They chased away all the animals we hunted for food. We had no choice. So, for the last time, we took up arms against them. No one honored the treaty.
When the treaty failed, many hundreds of Sioux families moved north to an area that is now in the state of Montana. Rain in the Face described what happened then.
In the spring, the Sioux got together near the Tongue River. It was one of the greatest camps of the Sioux that I ever saw. We had decided to fight the white soldiers until no warrior should be left. We crossed the Tongue River to the Little Bighorn. I was eating my food one day when suddenly the long-haired soldier chief called George Custer began to attack us. It was a great surprise. I heard a Sioux war cry. I saw a warrior riding his horse at top speed, giving the warning as he came. Then we heard the sound of soldiers' guns. I seized my gun, my bow and arrows, and my stone war club. As I was about to go join the fight, I saw a group of soldiers near us at the edge of a long line of cliffs across the small river. We all got on our horses and immediately started toward those soldiers. We quickly began to surround the soldiers. When the soldiers were surrounded on two sides, with the river on the third, the order came to attack. The soldiers tried to ride the other way, but they could not leave. They fired their guns at us as fast as they could. We mostly used bows and arrows. The soldiers fought very bravely until they were killed. I had always thought that white men were not brave, but I had a great respect for them after this day. No one knows who killed the soldier chief Longhair Custer. Many lies have been told about me. Some say I killed Custer or his brother Tom Custer that day. Why, in that fight, the excitement was so great that we could not recognize our nearest friends. Everything was done as fast as lightning. But that was long ago. I have lived in peace now for many, many years. No one can say rain in the face has broken the rules. I fought for my people and my country. When we lost, I remained silent as a warrior should. My warrior spirit died when I put down my weapons. Now, there is only my poor body that has lived on. Now, that too is almost ready to lie down for the last time. Nah, it is well.
Rain in the Face, one of the last great Sioux warriors, died at the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota on September 14th, 1905.
This special English program was taken from the book Indian Heroes and Great Chieftains by Dr. Charles Eastman. Doug Johnson was the voice of Dr. Eastman. Shep O'Neill was the voice of Rain in the Face. Our program was produced by Katie Weaver. Our studio engineer was Greg Burns. I'm Steve Ember. Join us again next week for another People in America program on the Voice of America.